It was the 1970s, and the young radical noticed the politically conservative bumper stickers on the car of a new acquaintance. An argument began immediately. It was hot and heavy until the radical's new friend stopped and said, "You are delightfully dumb. I'm going to undertake the task of educating you." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for Wyoming Catholic College's After Dinner Scholar podcast. The delightfully dumb radical is known today as Father Robert Sirico, who tells the story in his book Defending the Free Market, The Moral Case for a Free Economy. In addition to being a Catholic priest, Father Sirico is president and founder of the Acton Institute, quote, a think tank whose mission is to promote a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles, close quote. The story of how a 1970s radical became a stalwart defender of Christian truth and economic liberty involves a huge pile of books. Father Sirico was the commencement speaker at Wyoming Catholic College this past weekend and was kind enough to spend some time reflecting on his life among books and authors. Welcome, Father Sirico. After a new friend called you delightfully dumb, he handed you a reading list, which leads me to several questions simultaneously. The first is, you read what was on the list. You didn't simply call him a hater and walk away. What was the motivation there?
Well, I've always been a curious person. I mean, if you looked at my library, I defy you to determine what my philosophy of anything is based on my library, because it has everything in it. I have Marx and Engels and Trotsky and Hitler and, you know, plus the Austrians and the classics and stuff like that. So he was pointing out things I hadn't really thought through. And I thought, well, I'll look at this. And so I began reading, and I was intrigued by it because it was both a different way of thinking and it was a set of different things to think about.
And what was on the list? What did he suggest you read?
Well, actually, it wasn't just a list. He brought me two arms loaded with books. He bought the books. Which was impressive to me that he spent in those days, this is in the 1970s, he must have spent $150 on books.
Wow.
So I was very taken by that because it told me how seriously he looked at this. And among those books, it was a series of books on economics and history written largely by secular writers, Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom, Ayn Rand's Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, and Atlas Shrugged, and The Fountainhead. Ludwig von Mises's work, Socialism, and Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, and Friedrich Bastiat, The Law. It's a wonderful little book, a good book to start with. So I began pouring through these, and some of them were beyond my ability at that moment to really grasp. I mean, Mises is quite dense and takes a lot of pre-reading before you can read and get him, but some of the things I agreed with, some of the things I didn't agree with. I touched base with friends of mine who were on the left and asked them questions, and this became very interesting to me because they had the reaction that you thought I would have to this friend. In other words, they didn't call me a hater, but they just dismissed it. Mm-hmm. No, I haven't read that and I'm not going to read it. It's fascist. Well, define fascism. Well, no, we're not going to go there. You know. Well, what about the right to private property? Doesn't that give a person space for freedom and self-determination? Well, no, not like that. Well, then why? And then they wouldn't argue it any further. And when I kept bumping up against people who were afraid to engage the question, it made me suspicious that maybe I had made some assumptions. And so I just kept reading, and it really led, my whole life has been changed as a result of that, because it led to two conversions in sequence, not immediately. The first was this conversion from a political point of view about the right to private property, free trade, business, and the like. And the other conversion that came later, that was really predicated on this first conversion, resulted from my asking myself, who is man? Which is the psalmist question, right? Who is man that thou art mindful of, and the son of man that thou visitest him? It was at that point that I bumped back into God, which you know, I knew about as a child. The sister with the Baltimore Catechism really inculcated me with basic natural law Thomistic thinking, but I hadn't really kind of begun to unpack it. So here I am now in my mid-20s, able to ask deeper questions, and it resulted in my going to confession and recovering my faith.
You were baptized Catholic.
I was.
And then I read somewhere that you left the church when you were in your early teens.
Yes, my 13.
And then you became a Pentecostal minister.
I did at one point. A Pentecostal minister, you know, I was a preacher. You know, you don't need any formal training. I hadn't been to college or anything at that point. In fact, this conversion that we were just talking about really precipitated my going to college because I wanted to learn systematically about things. But so, yes, I was involved with the charismatic movement, with the Jesus movement, later on with the political left as well.
And I also read somewhere that it was in the question of what does it mean to be human, you read a lot of Augustine.
Well, you know, after I came back to the church, I had a spiritual director who asked me to think about the priesthood. And this is now years after the economic stuff and that, all of that. And this spiritual director knew my life in much more detail than I'm giving you here. And I was surprised that he suggested priesthood because I said, well, look at the kind of life I've lived. This would disqualify me. And he said, have you ever heard of St. Augustine? And I said, well, I've heard the name. He said, well, I suggest you read the Confessions, because here's a man who lived a life away from the church, steeped in heresy, had a child outside of marriage, so there was some sexual promiscuity.
Rather a lot, actually, I think.
Yes, yes. And the kind of entertainment he enjoyed, going to the arena and seeing people ripped apart, by beasts, was the kind of culture that I had been enmeshed in. He said, read this. And I did. Now, I have to admit, then, and as a matter of fact now, Augustine sometimes eludes me. I mean, he is so profound. I mean, this is one of the greatest minds of Western civilization. But I got enough of what he was saying to understand that he was describing my experience. In particular, the famous passage was, and I'm quoting it from memory now, I don't remember, there's a whole lot to it, but he says, he refers to this truth that he knew but didn't know, that it was always there but he didn't understand it, but that this truth was beckoning him, and he describes it as a beauty ever ancient, ever new. Long have I loved thee, O beauty, ever ancient, ever new. And what Augustine is saying is that I loved you but didn't know you, and you loved me and drew me to you. And that passage just spoke to me. I mean, I thought, here's this man writing this in the 4th century, and here I am at that time in the 20th century, and I found it compelling, you know, and that kind of made me think, well, you know, if God could do it with Augustine, maybe he could do it with me.
Just the honesty that he has in describing his life in the confession.
Yeah.
And the way God was always there kind of in the background, saying, excuse me, excuse me.
What I like about St. Augustine, I don't think St. Augustine actually said this. I think it may have been Chesterton characterizing Augustine, but it was something to the effect that even the man knocking at the brothel door is seeking God. Mm-hmm. And that's something embedded in Augustine, that no one ever acts upon a thing or toward a thing that they think is bad. They always think it's good. And the good that they think may not be in the thing, but is nonetheless the God that they're seeking for that fulfillment. And that's what resonated with me, you know, in all of the both doctrinal and moral failures that I had. I have to look back and say I really was seeking the truth. I was seeking God, but owing to my own intellectual deficiency and psychological or moral deficiencies, kept looking in the wrong place to find him.
Now, your decision to go into the priesthood,
I understood you read quite a bit of John Henry Newman.
I did, you know, and shortly after Augustine. That was the second book that this spiritual director said, because this is another man who had a series of conversions. And
which book was that?
The Apologia Pro Vita Sua. I was in England when I read Augustine. I had a year abroad from the University of Southern California where I'd been studying. And I remember on a long train trip was when I was reading the Confessions. I still have that volume, that dog-eared volume. But then when I was in classes in London, University of London, we were studying Victorian literature, and they mentioned Newman. I said, oh, that's right, I haven't read that yet. And I said, could I read this as part of it? They said, sure. And so I took the book out of the library one night, and I remember it was after dinner. I sat in my room and I began reading it, and I read through the night. I may have slept for a few hours, but I got up the next morning, had some breakfast, and kept reading, cut all my classes the next day, which I never did. I, you know, was a little older student, about 5 years older than most of my classmates, so I really was getting something out of this. But I cut my classes and finished the Apologia. Again, I didn't understand everything in that. I didn't know what a Monophysite was, or a Docetist, you know, because Newman goes through all this. He's a patristic scholar. But the force of the narrative, his beautiful prose, and the line of his conversion, I understood. I followed that. I remember in particular where Newman says in the Apologia that he thought doctrinally. And this was in an age, you know, when I was reading this, it was at a period of time where doctrine was dismissed as antiquated and sterile. And yet I did think doctrinally. And to hear Newman defend that and give reasons for the defense of that. And the other line I thought was fascinating, though I didn't know what it meant fully, he describes, he said, and then after all of this reading and these arguments, I looked in the mirror and saw myself a Monophysite, but the church was where the church always was in her position, having to do with the Trinity, the divinity of Christ. And I just recognized, again, a different dimension of my own story in that, and then I began looking at the priesthood more seriously, more systematically.
In your book, Defending the Free Market, you wrote, quote, civilizations fail. The reasons they fail is also plain. When civilizational virtues are eroded from within, people lose the capacity to defend the good things those habits enabled previous generations to achieve. Those words, I think, would make many Americans, and particularly many American Christians, kind of shudder. Is the West failing? Is America failing? And are we, and what do we need to do about it? What should we read?
It ought to make them shudder. It makes me shudder, because very slowly, we are losing a common grammar, an ability to even debate issues. We think we're debating issues, but we're not. I mean, we've gone in, one generation or two generations from the eloquence of the debate posture of a Bill Buckley on Firing Line, which I remember my dad making me watch, to the food fights of Sean Hannity. What you see on many of these news programs are not real debates at all. They're people insisting on some political talking point and talking past each other. A real debate is a clash of ideas that allows both sides to articulate itself and kind of seek for the truth. And that's the thing that I think we're losing. These civilizational values are predicated on a common grammar. I grew up in a very ethnically and religiously diverse area of Brooklyn in the 1950s, and yet we could speak to one another because we had this similar grammar, we had a similar moral vision, and we are losing that now, and we're at a very critical moment. The thing that gives me hope, or the two things that give me hope, is the veracity of our claim. So the truth will out. All these other things are illusions, and they will. The problem is that they leave a high cost when they're affected, but nonetheless, the truth will out. But the other thing, too, oddly enough, and a lot of conservatives, traditional people, criticize this, is the technology. I think people have access. What we have to do as believers, people who believe in the Western canon, people who believe in the Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition, is have to articulate this in an idiom, in a language that people can grasp. It's no different than the gift of the Holy Spirit on Pentecost, which enabled the truth of the gospel to go forth in a lot of different languages. We need a lot of different languages, and by that I don't just mean people being able to speak various literal languages, but modes of communication that a lot of young people today communicate through text and through visual things. I find it unsatisfying myself, but that's because I'm from a different generation. Mm-hmm. A good example of it is Hamilton, this story of the life of Alexander Hamilton, and it's all presented in rap. And I went to see it and was braced to be offended because I thought it was going to be politically correct, and I have to commit this, I'm not an aficionado of rap music. But what it was rapping in a certain cadence, in a certain form, the basic ideas of the American founding and the Constitution and the rest of it. And I had some kids who were sitting in front of me, captivated by this, that had it been presented in a sonorous, articulate, scholarly way, would have put them to sleep. And yet they were following these lines of thinking and these philosophical principles because the medium that was being presented was something they were familiar with. And I think we have to do that. A podcast is one way of doing it.
Well, good. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Great to be with you.
And thanks. Thank you for speaking at our graduation.
Honored to be here. 10th anniversary. This is great.
Oscar Wilde once quipped, "It is what you read when you don't have to that determines what you will be when you can't help it." As Father Sirico's life, my life, and perhaps your life as well, make clear, the power of good books to bring about change for the good cannot be overestimated. And that is, of course, the point of these After Dinner Scholar podcasts. Our hope is that hearing about the books we discuss, you'll want to encounter the books directly by reading them. As I mentioned briefly last week, the After Dinner Scholar is now available on iTunes. If you're enjoying the series, would you do us the favor of going to iTunes to rate and review the podcast? It will make a huge difference in the number of people we reach with the cultural transforming power of the great books and the liberal arts. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.